Welcome to the Good Person, Bad Person podcast.
How's it going? I am just a person.
Just a person, just normal, regular. I'm going to bleach my skin so I'm a little bit lighter.
Why? Person. Is it because are you Muslim?
No. I'm not going to be in a registry. I'm not signing up to. I'm so not Muslim. I'm wearing a safety pin, like lots of safety pins all over me because I'm that kind of an ally.
I safety pin my nips.
Oh.
Yeah. That's how hardcore white lady I am. So.
Yeah, that didn't work out the way that we thought it was going to work out.
I am such a fan of the president-elect. I just want to put that out there.
I'm not a fan of the president-elect. I'm so upset by
That's Taz speaking.
What happened on November 8th.
Zara, my name's not Zara. My name is Sarah, and I love Jesus. Please continue.
November 8th was election day, and we have a president-elect Trump, even though Hillary Clinton is up by over 1.5 million votes right now in popular vote.
1.75 now.
And this electoral college system is just really upsetting me.
You mean racism?
Racism, yeah. Because the whole point of electoral college is to give weight to the middle states.
Okay, I want to hear your election day story. What were you doing during the apocalypse?
So on election day morning, I woke up really early and I went and did poll monitoring at my local precinct. And it was really a beautiful experience because I live near Little Bangladesh in Los Angeles. And the first poll that I was monitoring had this hijabi Bangladeshi woman. And in LA, you're supposed to have people who speak multiple languages at the polls. And I went up to her and I said, "Tumi Bangla kotha bolte paro?" And she was like, "Yes, I speak in Bangla." And she responded in Bangla. And I was like, "This is so amazing that here in LA, we have a Bangladeshi hijabi woman." And she was like stylish too. Like she like had her election day outfit on. And then sitting next to her was a Korean guy. And then there was a Spanish speaking guy. And everyone had signs that said like, "I speak these languages." And then every precinct I went to monitor on election day had people speaking in multiple languages and such a rich diversity. And it was really great to see because we live in an amazing city where democracy is led by people of color. And that's how I left in the morning. And then I got really sad. Later that night, I went to a show for the Sweatshop Boys, which is Heems and Riz Ahmed. They have this duo rap group.
Riz Ahmed?
Uh-huh.
Like as in the night of Riz Ahmed?
Yeah.
That's who I was looking at on your Snapchat?
Yeah.
What?
Yes. I went to see them perform on election night, which was awesome because in one secret room, or in the back room, I should say, they had the results coming in and everyone was in the room just kind of watching it before the show started. And then the show started around like 8 o'clock. And it was great to be in a space. It was a sold out show. It was great to be in a space full of brown activists and young people who are really engaged in politics. And the Sweatshop Boys have really political lyrics. So you knew that the people that you were in the room with were just, you know, your people. These were the people who like came up to me and were like, "We listen to your podcast and I've read your stuff." And then like I recognized a bunch of people in the room too. Like the brother from Mindy Project was there and the lead singer of Young and the Giant was there. And it was just one of those spaces where you're just looking around. And you're like, okay, this is kind of awesome that you have like everyone who's like really political and kind of brown and kind of into music here in this space. And gosh, it was just super surreal. It was super surreal to have Riz Ahmed on stage singing a song about taking off your shoes while going through TSA, knowing that song was inspired by the events of September 11th, and all of a sudden we're going to have this reemergence of these same kind of laws and rules and society.
Fascism.
It was also super powerful, too, to be in a room full of, like, brown kids singing along to these songs because you're like, okay, this is going to be hard, but we have a group that's going to do it.
You had a community.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing some of your posts online and being like, not envious in that way, not mean envious, but like wishing that I had been around activist community at the time.
Where were you?
I was with my family in my parents' home in a Republican city.
Yeah.
And I specifically didn't watch any news like that whole day.
Yeah, I honestly think I wasn't watching the news either.
And I purposefully said, you know what? I'm not going to do this because it's been so difficult getting to this point anyway. And it's media Christmas tonight. They're going to try and make me think that he's going to win and freak me out. And then at the last minute, it's going to be fine. So I'm just going to skip to that. I'm going to turn off the television and I just stopped watching. And instead, I was watching Zero Days and Citizen 4, which are not great documentaries to have seen before realizing that you have a fascist president-elect.
Yeah.
0 Days is about the cyber attack on Natanz in Iran and our new cyber attack capabilities in cyber attack warfare.
Oh, why'd you watch that on election night?
Because I watch documentaries in my free time. And I was like, it's a free time day because I know how this election is going to go. And I had just watched Citizen 4, the Edward Snowden documentary.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, exactly. Oh, God.
Why would you do this?
Because that's how confident I was that it was going to be Clinton and we were going to be fine.
Yeah.
And then I started getting text messages from my friends. What the fuck is going on? Are you watching this? Like 100 exclamation marks, 100 question marks. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, you know what? This is why I didn't turn on the television. Media Christmas. And I just wrote back to them, it's going to be fine. I know it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And my parents were watching in the other room and they were like, Zara, like, are you looking at this? And I was like, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And then my husband called me and he was like, hey, how are you doing? And I was like, oh, yeah, like, everybody's freaking out. And he explained it to me that, no, this is real. Turn on your television. And we both started to cry and tried not to. And I watched CNN and then I just kept CNN on until 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was just, I was hanging on Van Jones's every word. And I was watching Corey Lee Wandowski in this arc of going from what I saw as him sort of understanding that it was a space of disagreement and respecting that to toward the end of it where it was very clear that Trump was winning. He had won. And then Hillary conceded after that point. I saw him in his body language to Van Jones and realized it's real. This is what's happening. And I was terrified. And I went on to the Canadian immigrant registry. And
which crashed that day.
And then I thought, I'll wait an hour. And it still was crashed. And then 2 days later, because my dad saw how scared I was, he came up to me and he said, here. And he, like, showed me the registry is working again. And it basically was a page that was like, hey, leave your email. Don't call us. We'll call you, American citizens trying to flee this way. And that was it. I was up till 4 in the morning.
Yeah, I couldn't sleep. I went to bed. And then I woke up at 2. And then I just could not stop looking at Facebook and Twitter. Just obsessive.
Yeah, same.
Obsessively.
I started to get really angry at everyone around me who was white. Because I felt like they had no idea what was coming at me. Like, what was about to come at me. And I just wanted to be around my people. Just people of color. People who understood. I couldn't go outside. I was scared to go outside because I was scared I'd walk into spaces that were celebrating.
Yeah. Especially, like, where you live.
Yeah. Did L.A. have any, like, people celebrating?
I don't think so. L.A. took to the streets immediately. We had the launch of the Potluck Podcast Collective in Los Angeles, which is our Asian American collective of awesome podcasts. We had our launch party on the 9th. We didn't think... We planned it without knowing that this was going to happen. We were like, okay, we're just going to throw an event because it's convenient for all of us. And then on my way to the event, which was at Soul Sausage in Little Tokyo, there was all these helicopters overhead. You know that people were taking to the streets. In Los Angeles, there was no celebration. But, I mean, we're in a blue city, and it was definitely a blue win here. The feeling in L.A. was more like, holy shit. How could the rest of the country do this to us? And I think that's still, like, what I'm feeling.
Yeah, I was, like, so upset that she conceded.
Yeah, I was actually really surprised she conceded, considering that in the Gore-Bush election, it took a while for that concession to happen.
Yeah, they took it all the way to the Supreme Court.
I also found it really upsetting that knowing how elections work and knowing that it takes a while for the votes to be counted, that anyone could concede so early on. Like, I'm still standing by that because Clinton is up by 1.7 million votes, and I think that someone who is winning the popular vote by so much should not have conceded so quickly.
And in other news, Bernie Sanders is everywhere working. I felt like I didn't see her, you know, out there pushing, fighting back against some of Trump's policies that he's been trying to put into place or some of the claims to, like, what he's going to do in his first 100 days. Like, she's not been active.
But I don't think it's her place to be active. If I got, like, trounced the way she did, I would also be, like, hiding out. I mean, like, I wasn't even running for office and I'm not out there.
I would get that for, like, a couple of days after, but considering what's at stake, I would not stop fighting.
I disagree. I think who I want to see fighting right now is our actual president. Like, I mean, granted, Obama has gone out and, like, said that we need to, like, come to agreements and, you know, we need to, like, move forward together. Like, Obama has 2 months left. I think that, like, he needs to be the one. He's still our president. He needs to go and stop what's happening at Standing Rock. He needs to go and cancel NSEERS. He needs to go and put in some laws to make what's going to be happening after January 20th way more difficult.
But he's deadlocked, right? Like, the Senate and the House aren't going to let him do anything.
There's a lot he can still do. That's who I want to see step up. I don't think, I mean, Hillary doesn't have any more power. Now she's a nobody. But Obama is still our president. And I think I want to see him step it up.
Yeah, I'm with you. Well, and so we're going to talk more about this up and coming in the rest of the podcast.
Yeah.
I also want to hear your university experience in the days after.
Yeah, so both you and I had really interesting out-of-town experiences after Election Day. I agreed to go to Texas State University to speak that Saturday after elections. Well, okay, after Election Day, like, I immediately drove out to see my family because I was so scared and I just needed to be around family. So after the event on the 9th, I, like, drove out to see my family. And then the very next day, I was flying out to Austin and I was supposed to give the keynote talk at this thing called Equality University, which is their Day of Diversity with all these amazing students who do awesome activism. So a couple days before I was supposed to fly out, I got an email from the organizers of the event and they were like, just so you know, Trump vigilantes put up signs all across the campus saying that they are going to murder and torture anyone involved with diversity on campus. Just for your information. And I was like, what? This is a diversity conference. And I'm giving the keynote and I'm scared for my life. Because
I was scared for you.
These people who were Trump supporters all of a sudden felt empowered to put up these flyers, anonymous flyers all across the campus.
Did they offer security measures, security measures for you?
And then I said, what's the security measure? Like, what are you doing? They said, we've notified campus police. And I was like, great. Like, most campus police are not like real police. It's different in Texas. In Texas, they all carry weapons. But at the same time, like, I know that Sandra Bland got arrested and quote unquote committed suicide, though we know that that didn't happen in Texas, right? This is Sandra Bland country. And this is also the state where the clock incident happened with the student Ahmed. Right. This is the state where the swimming pool incident happened with the kids who were trying to swim and they were attacked by the police. So Texas doesn't really have a great reputation when it comes to cops. So when they said that there's going to be protection by cops, I was just like, well, what does that? That doesn't mean anything. And then after I started doing research, I remember that we had talked about this. In August 2016, Texas public universities became a campus carry university. This means that it is legal for students to carry concealed weapon onto public university, which Texas State University is one of.
Yeah, no thanks.
And we talked about it on our podcast about how there was women that were walking around Texas public university with dildos because you're not allowed to carry a dildo on campus.
What?
We talked about this in our podcast.
Oh my God, I don't remember anything before the apocalypse.
So we talked about this in our podcast about how in protest of this rule, people were walking around with dildos. So I immediately emailed the organizer of the event if I could have a dildo on the podium. And he said, no, there were going to be high school kids there. Anyways, at least I asked because I had to ask given the situation. And I was really scared. But then I watched this video of the students at Texas State University. And it was a video from the Thursday after Election Day. And they were in the center of campus. And they had these signs saying that they're in love and they're in harmony. And it was like all kinds of people that were standing in front of their campus center. And I heard afterwards that they got a lot of pushback at this vigil that they held, this love vigil. It was just watching that video. I was like, these are the students that I need to go for. Like, I don't know what to say to them, but this is their moment and they need someone like me to let them know what we did in 2004 and what we did in past elections and maybe give them some support. And it was like, I can't imagine being a student at a concealed carry campus where these Texas vigilante signs are. Like, that kind of fear must be so ever present. I was just going in for a day. I can't imagine what they were having to deal with on a constant basis.
That should be criminal.
Should be criminal. I mean, they're trying to figure out who put up the signs and it is a hate crime that they did that. But it should be criminal to be able to take guns onto any campuses. at all.
Especially considering this country's history.
Yeah, and the fact that this just happened like 2 months ago in August 2016. So when I gave my keynote...
Yeah, your keynote is about all of these like forms of resistance from the last 15 years.
Yeah, and I just was not inspired to give it. I gave it. I talked about everything that we did, and I drew the context that what people are experiencing now is very similar to the feelings that I had when I was 24 and organizing with South Asian American voting youth on these college campuses. And that feeling of loss and empowerment that I felt in the 2004 elections was very similar to this kind of loss that we're feeling now. And I got to the point in my presentation where I talk about how we did the API art delegation to Ferguson. And I have this really cute picture of me and Jenny Yang and D'Lo, and we're with the people from Hands Up United. And I'm talking about police brutality. I'm talking about how Black Lives Matters and how it was great to be out there, and how Jenny and D'Lo were telling bad police jokes in front of the Ferguson PD. And as I'm telling this, I like look up and I see the cop standing in the back of the room, and he's got this bulletproof vest on, and you know, he has short cropped blonde hair. And I'm like hesitant because I'm talking about how bad the police are, and this police is standing in the back of the room because I asked for him to be there. But if something had happened, would he have jumped in front of the bullet? You know, like,
you know, I'm confident answering that question. You know why? Because after the shooting at the Black church, Dylan Roof was given a bulletproof vest.
Yeah.
And the cops stood around him to protect him.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty confident in saying that the answer would be no, because you are not their people, according to who may be Trump's policy advisor.
Right. And I think that's like a lot of what we're going to end up seeing is that, I mean, we're seeing it now with all these anti-Muslim hate crimes that are happening. People don't want to report it to their local police because they know that their police aren't going to support them. So I don't know. I just like, I left feeling so ultimately unsafe. And I'm so upset with everyone who wants to wear these stupid fucking safety pins, because it's like, I don't really need someone to wear a safety pin to save me. I need someone to like go with me to these events and be the person that's standing in front of the cop to make sure that nothing happens. Like, I need that kind of protection. And then I just like ended up going back to the hotel and just feeling like I lost it. I was just like, this is what it means to be a leader now. Like, you're literally having to put your life on the line.
Yeah, there's that quote. I can't remember who it's from now, but it goes, you're not a revolutionary if you're not afraid for your life.
Yeah, that's definitely me.
Which I hear and then remember that I am not a revolutionary, and I am here to be Sarah, the Trump supporter.
Oh, God.
At the Good Person, Bad Person podcast. That's a joke, by the way. Jesus.
So that was my experience, but you had a really amazing experience, too, that I want to hear about.
Is amazing the word? Illuminating.
Illuminating.
Illuminating. I think I had some kind of PTSD when I got the news because, I tell this story often. I told the story in our first podcast. My brother had cancer when he was 15. I was 19. I'm his big sister. And it progressed because of a racist doctor. That doctor said to my mom when she said, my son is having hip pain. She herself is an x-ray tech. You know, and she said, he's got fevers and has for the last 2 weeks, and I'm worried, and I'd like to get an x-ray. And he said, listen, I know your people. You treat your sons like princes. He's fine. You're just spoiling him. And then when she went to the emergency room to get the x-ray that showed a gray spot, he scolded her for having gone over his head. And then when he told my parents, if you want an MRI, then you're going to have to pay for it out of pocket. And my parents paid out of pocket for a specialist. That specialist called him and said, I can't get this MRI even when they're paying out of pocket unless you sign off on it. Because that's how healthcare worked back then, mm-hmm. before Obamacare, before the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
And he made my parents wait outside with a security guard while he signed off on it. And then we had a $1 million lawsuit lined up against this guy, because also it takes millions to pay for 2 bone marrow transplants and 2 years of chemotherapy and 6 weeks of radiation, which is what my brother needed, because that's how far progressed his cancer was due to this doctor's actions. And the guy apologized and said, I was just trying to save you money. You know, we had everything lined up. We had a doctor willing to testify. 9/11 happened. The lawyer dropped the case. No lawyer would pick it up. This one lawyer leveled with my parents and said, listen, 9/11 just happened. There's no judge or jury in the world who is going to look at you with your last names and see you with that thing around your head and side with you against an American doctor. Statute of limitations went by. That's at the break of 9/11, mm-hmm. okay? And that doctor's behavior was pre-9/11. Mm-hmm. And this all happened in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is supposed to be like the bastion of liberalism. So I was absolutely terrified. Like, I'm hearing Trump say that he's going to get rid of Obamacare. I'm hearing, like, him denying that the people that are in his cabinet, they have ties to white supremacy, even though they're expressive about it, and all this gaslighting. And I was so scared. And I sent a text to Kamau Bell, who I am fortunate to be able to say is a friend of mine. And I was like, hey, can we talk sometime in person? And he called me right away and was like, I feel like I can hear you getting in the lifeboat and the flare go up. And I was like, yeah, that's about where I'm at. I don't know how safe I am. And he said, listen, I'm in Dearborn right now. Come join me. Come over here. So I went to Detroit and I went on, I feel like, a tour of Michigan, basically, that I feel like I never would have gotten otherwise, because Kamau's show, United Shades of America, is like basically the Anthony Bourdain of racism.
Yeah.
So it was just like this really tasty palette of racism all over Michigan, which Michigan was one of the notorious swing states. And as I'm entering this state, I am being driven in by a pro-Trump Muslim.
Oh, I thought that was a myth.
Not only is it not a myth, it's a huge problem.
How do they exist?
By lying.
I mean, they're lying?
Yeah, because
or during being lied to.
Well, probably a little of both. I mean, of course, a little of both. They were so misinformed.
Oh, that's so terrible.
And I feel like the story is so perfect because it like so perfectly encapsulates like what it takes to be a pro-Trump Muslim. This is my Uber driver. He picks me up and he's all chipper.
Right.
I am not.
Right.
And at that moment, I just assumed that it was like because he's doing his job and that's cool. And like my sort of toned down self will let him know, like, we don't need to play this game right now, sir. Like, we're both miserable, right?
Yeah, we're both brown.
Yeah. No, he is so happy. He says, oh, how are you doing? And I said, oh, you know, I mean, the election. And he was like, oh, yeah, but I'm going to be so glad to be rid of Obamacare.
Why?
Right? I was like, excuse me? And he was like, that Obamacare, I'm so sick of it. Do you know how much I was paying per month? $180 a month.
Sounds kind of cheap to me.
Exactly. I was like, well, I used to be paying $550 a month just for me. So I'm pretty glad about Obamacare. And he goes, well, I don't even need the doctor. Do you know how often I go to the doctor? Never. When was the last time I saw a doctor in the 5 years? Never. I was paying for nothing. And then I had to pay the $500 cancellation fee. And I was like, yeah, because, you know, that's what tax dollars are.
Yeah.
Is you take care of each other in a country. That's what it's for.
You said this.
Yeah. And he was like, I don't see a reason to pay it. I mean, this country is crazy. And he goes on to say how he feels like we're ridiculous in the things that we invest in, like our teeth.
What?
Yeah, like our teeth. Then he says, you know how much my dentist wanted to charge me for a cavity filling? It was $1,700. I told him, take my tooth out. So he did. And I said, take the rest of them out. And my dentist wouldn't.
The healthy teeth?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So then he says that he had to go back to Yemen to get a dentist to remove all of his healthy teeth.
His healthy teeth.
He got rid of all of his teeth. And then he said, look at these. I have these beautiful ones here. And he shows me his false teeth. And he goes, they're perfect.
Wait, so I mean, like, was he old?
No, he was my age.
So this motherfucker got all of his teeth pulled out.
Yeah.
Just because of one rotting tooth.
Right. Because he was like, I'm never going to be put in a position to have to pay $1,700 to save a tooth ever again. I'm just going to be proactive.
Can't he just fucking brush his teeth?
I would have paid $500 for him to just keep his stupid Obamacare and vote Clinton.
I would have bought him toothbrushes and toothpaste for a lifetime.
This is the Muslim man that voted for Trump. And then he goes on to add, also I voted for Trump. Because I like that he's gonna get Iran.
Did he know you were Iranian?
After that, I said, I'm Iranian. And he said, oh.
And then did you get kicked out of the Uber car or what?
You think this man that's all about saving money is gonna kick me out of his Uber car? No, I don't think so.
Did you give him a 1-star rating?
It wasn't up to me. A friend of mine got it for me.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
You should have, like, rated it 1-star.
I didn't even want to because I was like, I don't know how to reach out to a person like this. What do you do to a person like this? Do I reach out to this person or do I slap him in the face?
This guy had all of his teeth pulled out. So I think this one's one of the unreachable ones. I mean, I think there's, like, Muslim Trump voters and I think there's, like, this kind of Muslim Trump voters.
Okay, but then I met a lot of those, Taz.
Wow.
I met another Trump voter who was a 19-year-old girl wearing hijab.
Oh my gosh.
And she says, and I quote, well, when you put us in a position to have to either vote for a crooked Hillary or Trump, how am I supposed to vote?
You vote for Clinton.
Yeah.
Never vote for Trump. Never vote for the fascist dictator. Never.
She missed that memo.
Oh my gosh. She better be the first one in the fucking line for the internment camp. That's all I gotta say. All these motherfucking Muslim Trump voters in swing states, first to go. First to the camps.
You know what she said about that?
What'd she say?
It's not gonna be that bad.
She said the camps aren't going to be that bad? Like,
she said they're not going to come after us like that. That's all stuff that people are saying. That's crooked Hillary talk.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Did she not read history? Do they not teach about the Japanese internment camps to these folks? Do they not go to the Holocaust Museum and learn about Hitler or learn about how concentration camps are happening all across this world for different programs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like I was having sort of like Muslim to Muslim conversations with all of these people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the show itself is like a whole separate thing.
Right.
Like, this was just me thinking that, like, oh, I see a Muslim person. I can have like a conversation. Right. Like, this is a time where I want to be around my people. Nope.
I have nothing to say to that. I'm super stunned.
I can't believe that I was in a state that was a swing state.
Yeah, it's surprising to me that all this was happening in a state where the amount of vote that Clinton lost by was something like 30,000. Like, that girl's vote totally counted, and she voted to have us all fucking go into the Muslim registry and get manipulated by this fucking fascist dictator.
Well, and ask me how many of them were pro-gay rights.
How many of them?
None.
What? So you had that conversation with them too?
Yeah, there were a couple who were trying to take care of the conservative Muslims that don't believe in gay rights and trying to hold space for that because it's like this big controversy in the Quran, right? And it was clear that like the people who were pro-gay rights were having to be really careful about it with a conservative bent.
I just want all of these people now, like, we're, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks in, and now we have, like, the white nationalist, neo-Nazi White House lined up. Like, what are these people thinking? Like, all these people that voted for Trump that were like, oh, Hillary was crooked. Like, are they like, cool, we have
a white fascist dictator?
Yeah, like,
I don't think that these people who voted for Trump, I don't think they know what white supremacy is. And I say this as a person who grew up in a white Republican town and with a Persian narrative of we're white, we're white, we're white. Like in the Arab American Museum in Dearborn,
yeah,
is their certificate granting them white status.
Oh my gosh.
I don't think that they are understanding or valuing the fact that we're putting Black people's lives in an incredible amount of danger. And the subtext of saying that they think they're going to be fine is, I'm going to pass.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And that's so upsetting and frightening. And I quit. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, how can I continue to encourage Muslims to go vote if this is how they're going to vote? Like, how can my career of encouraging people to have a political identity and to have people power based on what I thought was a social justice value when it comes to Islam, how can I continue to do this job knowing that this is what people are going to do with it?
I don't know how to be a comedian with a gun to my head. So basically, both of us don't know what our jobs are anymore.
Basically. And with that, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Good Muslim, Bad Muslim.
Yeah, that's right. We're not backing down. We're still here. I thought it was really interesting. Someone on Twitter had said, are you guys still recording? Like we're going to not record just because we're scared for our lives.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm not scared.
We'll be less scared if you can buy one of our safety pins that we're providing to allies for $2,000.
Yes, website. That's not a joke, by the way. That's a real thing.
We really do have safety pins available for $2,000.
Like, if you want to actually connect your quote-unquote safety pin to action and not just liberal chic,
yeah,
help us out. Support.
Yeah. It'll support buying our equipment. It'll support our sound engineer. It'll support making sure that we have enough LaCroix.
It also sustains us to be able to do what we do because I have a feeling that a lot of harassment is about to come our way.
Yeah, we might need some protection.
And 'tis the season of giving.
Yeah, for all you not Muslim givers.
So show up.
This is a good Christmas gift.
Yeah, I mean, people can group together with their friends to coordinate.
Jesus was a prophet.
We believe that.
Yeah, Jesus, Yusuf. Jesus, all the same.
We are about to enter into an era where I will have to say whatever it is that our fascist dictator wants me to say, because that is the country we'll be living in.
And then we'll be doing rebellious radical messages underground. I'll be doing radical rebellious messages underground. I'll bring Zara along, though. We'll figure this out.
You'll be doing the messages while I'm building the boat.
Yeah.
Go right ahead, Taz. Got you back. I'll be, like, sanding the oars.
What?
Like, I'm imagining that I'm building the boat.
Do you have to sand oars?
Well, yeah.
Oh.
You gotta watch more documentaries, man. I'm on top of this.
So we have some big topics we wanted to talk about. We did talk a lot already, but there's been so much stuff that's happened since Election Day. We definitely wanted to touch upon some more stuff. So did Muslims turn out to vote? This is the big question.
We had more than 1 million Muslim voters.
Yeah. There was a 1 million Muslim voter project that was happening. Empower was one of the main folks that was out there. CARE was out there, too.
The Wujahat said that there were some mosques claiming that Clinton and Trump were the same, so their vote wouldn't matter.
Yeah, and that really upset me. How did you feel about that? I mean, you were in swing state Michigan where you saw this happen.
Yeah, like, I remember seeing, I think Wujahat Ali put out, and a couple of other activists put out some great stuff that was like, the Republicans should keep in mind that the Muslim vote actually got Bush elected, and that the Muslim vote does matter. And at the time, I remember scoffing at it, being like, everybody knows how Muslims are going to vote. We only have one president we can vote for to be safe.
Yeah.
Ha! Just kidding, Zara.
Yeah.
You don't know shit. Because a lot of Muslims voted for Trump.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, like, I think
the Muslims in swing states,
yeah,
like Michigan, who I met.
I think the Pew report quoted before elections that about 7% of Muslims were voting for Trump. I would imagine that number went up more. But I think the thing that also that I keep reflecting on when it comes to numbers in voting this election cycle is that 44% of eligible voters didn't even turn out to vote.
Yeah.
And technically, more people voted for Clinton than Trump. So every time everyone says America has spoken, every time anyone says that, I just get really upset because there was so many non-voters that didn't turn out to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And their inaction has led to this to happen.
But see, it still bothers me, though, that we even talk about the vote because she won the popular vote.
Yes.
So people did speak.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then on top of that, I feel like it detracts from the fact that the Electoral College is racist.
So racist.
And fucked up. And that it's put us in a huge amount of danger. And I have a heightened alarm around anything that distracts from what is keeping me from Muslim internment.
I think for me, it's like the Electoral College was put in place to prevent stuff like what's happening from happening. And if we really want the Electoral College to work, we need to be emailing them and calling them and pressuring them to not go by what has happened.
Okay, 6 people have tried to explain the Electoral College to me.
Uh-huh.
Let me try reiterating to see if I actually have it this time. The Electoral College is made up of some peeps.
Random peeps.
Random peeps.
Yeah.
And they, in some states, have to vote according to the popular vote. Like, it's just automatic.
Yeah.
And in some states, they don't have to.
Yep.
And this change is a recent change.
Yeah.
That, like, it didn't used to be this way. Like, in the grand scale of this country's history.
Yeah.
It sort of morphed in its role.
Right.
The Trump aggression that is happening in this country right now, that according to Trump today to the New York Times, he disavowed. Did you hear about this?
He disavowed what? He can't disavow anything. He's the president-elect.
He went into the New York Times today. They did a live tweet.
Right.
Where he said, I am in no way condoning any of the violence that's happening. Basically, he said, I disavow it. He didn't say what he disavows, but he just said, I disavow it.
Can someone please explain to him what disavow means? Like, I don't think he's using it right.
I don't think he cares. So basically, he's distancing himself from it. He's saying, whatever's going on, like, we're going to look into it. I don't approve of it, is what he's saying. It makes sense to me why, as a strategy, Trump supporters are being so aggressive and violent right now, because if I was managing that campaign, I would need the entire rest of the country to feel like I was bigger.
Yeah.
And louder and more present.
For sure.
Because you already have more than half the population who voted for the other person.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I was thinking about is that every other situation like this, the president after Election Day was always about bringing the country together and uniting and trying to be listening to both sides. And this guy just doesn't even care.
It's really scary how, like, we jump so quickly to the Muslim registration.
3 days.
3 days. And we're just, like, flying past the white supremacists that are in his cabinet.
I don't think we're flying past. It's just like every day there's something. At 18 Million Rising, we put out a call to try to get everyone to call the representative to make sure that Steve Bannon doesn't get put into the White House. And that was our most successful campaign yet. We got over 800 people calling in using our tool. If you haven't made your call yet, you can still do it. Go to 18mr.org to make sure that you can make your call. So, I mean, like, that's just my little pushback. It's like, I think people are responding. One of the things that I heard coming from McCain's office was that someone who had called McCain's office, their constituent, the person that picked up the phone, it was a Muslim person that had called in, said that you're blocking up our lines for real constituents. So even, like, the fact that McCain's staff is saying that, I think speaks to the fact that, like, these actions are, like, actually making a difference. The sad thing is that I feel like all these calls are detractors. Like, from here until the next 4 years, we're going to have to be constantly calling. This isn't like a call because of crisis. This is a calling is just now going to be a part of our daily interaction with the government. This needs to be habit because it's going to get so bad. Like, calling is the bare minimum that people need to be doing. There's things that we really need to be doing, and we actually can't anticipate that because it's going to be so fucked up and it's going to be unprecedented that we really don't know how to anticipate what our next actions are supposed to be.
Okay, so this is really important to me because I feel so helpless right now as an individual. I feel also like I'm being herded, that all around me are lions and we are sprawled zebras, and I'm terrified. What you're telling me is that one way to experience agency, like for me, is wake up in the morning and have my call list.
Yep. Everyone should have their everyday call list of everyday actions. And I think it was you that shared this, sign up for this website, and they would give you weekly tasks to do so that you could have agency and so that you can organize. And I think that's such a great idea of getting people to sign up for a list where they can say, like, okay, this is what I have to do this week. I have to make these many calls, and I might have to wear my safety pin, and I might have to make these calls, and I might not be able to get Trump completely out of office, but this is what I can do right now. And I think that's so great that people are trying to be creative with how we engage people.
The Muslim registry is probably the hardest thing for me right now. Every single time that I hear it, every single time that somebody sends me like a forward about it, I go from 0 to 60, because I think of like what happened to my family, how easy it was for that to happen. And we're going to talk more about this, but I see like NOADPL right now and the like Standing Rock and the work that they're doing and the violence that they're experiencing on behalf of the state.
Yeah.
And what can I do about it? I'm across the country.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I'm doing what I can to like to contact the people necessary, to make the phone calls necessary, to post what I can, to stand in solidarity, to bring awareness. What is it doing? Is it stopping it?
But it's, you know, if you buy them a sweater, it'll keep them warm. If you send them medicine, it'll take care of these people. There's like those little things are going to matter on the ground.
They do matter. And what I'm trying to highlight is that I think that people don't understand the amount of danger that Muslims are in.
Yeah.
That like when people are like, I'll sign up for the register.
You can't sign up for the register. When people say that, it makes me so mad. Because here's the thing. The Muslim registry existed in 2002. I was 23 at the time. I was running around Washington, D.C., going to all these South Asian markets and restaurants. I had these flyers. They were Know Your Right flyers. And we would go up to all these uncle and aunties and people who were my age and just say, like, okay, this is a registry. These are the countries. If your origin is from this country, this is what you need to do. And that registry existed from 2002 to 2011. That's Obama era. Like, it lasted well into President Obama's administration. It led to the deportation of 14,000 people, and not one terrorism attack came out of that. So this was just a way to purge people of Muslim origins out of this country without having a terrorist attack because of it. Like, nothing happened because of it except that we had a reason to export Muslims out of this country. And it wasn't like white people could have gone to Homeland Security's office and say, like, sign me up for that too. Even though I was born in the U.S., I can still sign up to be of origin from Yemen. You know, like, that's not an option. So every time everyone says, A, that they're going to sign up for the Muslim registry, you can't. Because
that's not how it works.
That's not going to be an option. B, where were you in 2002 to 2011 when this was happening? Why is this the first time you're actually talking about signing up for a list when lists have existed? The list existed for this program, which is referred to as NCERS. The list existed for the no-fly list after 2002. And my name was so similar to someone's name on the list that I had to have a special call every time I flew. No one was like trying to sign up for the no-fly list. And then finally, you have all these other forms of surveillance happening in our country where you have stop and frisk, you have FBI informants going into the mosque. And where are these so-called allies stepping in to try to like be an ally there? So, I mean, it's all nice and dandy that people are saying that they're going to sign up for the Muslim registry list, but it's not logistically going to work that way. Like, stop saying that. Try to like be a little bit more practical, be a little bit more strategic, and step into that space of an ally for real, for real. Because we can't have this like really weak versions of allyship when this is it. This is like, we've escalated our tactics. It's time to go. You are all ready. You are all trained. We've been like practicing for the past 15 years. This is our time to figure out how we're going to do this.
And passing is not an option.
It's not an option.
And on Fox News, they are discussing Japanese internment as like not being such a bad thing.
I don't understand this. Don't people take history class here?
I mean, I would argue, yes, they do. They're white supremacists.
Right.
So their opinions are a little bit different about how history went.
The story of the Japanese internment is one that is closely tied to Southern California, since most of the Japanese Americans that went there came from the West Coast and they were sent to Manzanar. And when they left Manzanar, a lot of them returned back to California. So we have a lot of folks in Southern California who are connected to this community. Anyways, on this TV show, it was Megyn Kelly who was interviewing Carl Higbee. Carl Higbee said that the internment holds constitutional muster.
Oh, what does that even mean?
It means that the Korematsu versus Supreme Court ruling that was fighting for the right for internment not to happen, it never got overturned.
The Korematsu versus United States case never was overturned. So it was never officially determined by the federal court that it is a human rights violation to intern people.
There was an official apology that was given in...
I don't need an apology!
2011. But that was as close as we got to recognition that this was a terrible thing.
Why is that? Is it because they don't want to take away the precedent where if they think that there's enemies to the state based off a race, that they still want to be able to have that precedent? Oh, goody.
Yes, I'm nodding.
I don't think that people get the kind of McCarthy-esque era that we could be entering into here.
I think people get the kind of McCarthy-esque
era. They do not get it. The people I am around do not get it.
The people I'm around definitely understand that.
You work with activists.
I work with activists, but I'm also like in Los Angeles. I think in Southern California, this Japanese internment narrative is very strong. Like, this is something that anyone in Southern California really resonates with. And I don't think it's an activist mentality. I think it's when you have to exist and live side by side next to different kinds of people of color. These are the stories that we hear about.
I am around Bay Area folks that say things like, relax, calm down. It's going to be fine. That won't happen. It's not possible. Never again. I'll register.
Yeah, I'm not around those people.
Also, like when I was performing, I did a gig and it was like a activist foundation. And I go to the bathroom. While I'm in the bathroom stall, I hear a woman say, I don't know about this whole sign up for the Muslim registry thing. I get why that's important, but I just survived cancer. I don't need to get shot. I'm not putting my name on the registry.
Which is so ridiculous.
Like, that's an insane statement in 100 ways.
Yeah. Did you, like, walk out of the bathroom and, like, wash your hands next to her, like, slowly and sneakily?
No, I cried in my bathroom stall. Because at least for once, I heard somebody be real.
Mm-hmm.
In the moment when someone comes knocking on my family's door, you are not jumping in with arms against whoever that is, the FBI, the police,
totally.
Some militia. You're not. So quit saying it.
Yeah.
And quit appeasing your mind of this necessary alarm because you think it. I'm angry.
I'm angry too. I'm also angry because since Election Day, there's been an incidence of 700 hate crimes.
Since Election Day?
Since Election Day.
700?
Mm-hmm. Not just anti-Muslim hate crimes, but just hate crimes invoked in the name of Trump. At least 700, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has been documenting all of the incidences that are happening. And these are incidences against brown and black and undocumented and disabled.
And Jewish.
All kinds of people, all in the name of Trump. And it's been exponential since Election Day. And another site, which you can go to, Islamophobia.org, has been documenting all of the anti-Muslim hate crimes that are happening. And up to now, we've had 111.
111 anti-Muslim, 700 total hate crimes.
Since Election Day.
And I've seen a bunch of swastikas around.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah. This is our America. I feel like we're in some sort of sci-fi novel.
It's bizarre because also while this is all happening here in the United States, like Germany and Merkel are like our last hope because it looks like Le Pen might win and Brexit happened. Basically, like Europe is turning into this fascist front.
Yeah.
We've got that here. This is so bizarre.
It's super bizarre. It's like no one read history. It's the third time I've said that, but like, I really, for me, it really goes back to the legacy that we have come from and the legacy we're trying to move away from. And if people just read their history books, we would realize we're just repeating history over and over again. One more hate crime I wanted to mention, which is the scariest one that I've heard, is that two men were driving in a car in Texas, I mean, at the state I was just in.
Yes.
And this truck comes up next to them and the guy thinks that they're stopping to ask for directions and he rolls down the window and they threw something on fire into the car and he gets third degree burns on his arms and first and second degrees on his face just because he looked Muslim. And this is what we have to deal with. And the thing is about how hate crimes get recognized as hate crimes is you have to stop the person that committed it. They have to say something hateful that you could quote. And just like there's... like, we know this is a hate crime because this is in light of this election and they're feeling emboldened and stuff.
I do want to say I have one positive safety pin story.
Okay. I still really hate the safety pins. Unless you buy one of our wonderful safety pins off of our website for the cost of $2,020. It's on there, goodmuslimbadmuslim.com.
Well, and that's why I want to mention it, is because when they're tied to action... you know what I mean? Like, they should be something granted. They shouldn't be something that you just wear.
Yeah.
Also, it means something. Like, geography means something. Like, I don't want to speak for people who are living in a city where they need to see that to actually feel safe.
Oh, yeah.
And there are people who live in those kinds of spaces that need to see it. For me, the day that I just, like, grabbed all my shit and left for Detroit because I had to... you know, I'm doing all this work and meanwhile, like, I'm a freelancer. I'm on contract. And I had to call the person that I was on contract with and say, like, I'm sorry, I can't come in to run the workshop today.
Yeah.
Like, I had a contract with this person for two workshops and two meetings.
Yeah.
And I called her at 6 a.m. to cancel them all. And she sent me a picture of her safety pin and said, I got you. Go do what you do. I need hope to stay alive. And she paid for those workshops. She paid the payment of those workshops, even though I wasn't there.
Yeah.
To support me. And that just made me, like, bawl on the plane.
Okay, fine. In that situation, safety pins are fine. Fine. I'll go with it. But generally speaking.
Well, okay. I will say, like, I would fucking fatwa the woman who was trying to sell gold safety pins on Etsy. The white woman selling gold safety pins on Etsy for $351.
Yeah, no.
So that's bullshit.
Give that money to us. We will take it and we'll give you a safety pin.
It's not like we don't have expenses.
And finally, I just wanted to close out the section with talking about, like, how are you going to stay safe besides safety pins, which aren't a way to keep safe.
I'm really looking forward to this segment from you because I need to hear it too. Like, how are we staying safe?
I mean, the question is, like, I don't really know how to stay safe, but I will say this. Like, if you're a woman, learn self-defense. If you are spending a lot of time on the internet, take some online security courses. As we enter into financial instability in this country, make sure that your finances are figured out. Like, do all the things that you're procrastinating on doing. Just do that for the next 2 months. Like, do a little bit every day. And there's this awesome website called theworldisaterribleplace.com/ohcrap.
I'm not going to forget that website.
Don't forget that one. It actually started by a bunch of activists and organizers. It was a Google Doc that was crowdsourced of different things to kind of keep track of as you move forward into this
unprecedented in some ways.
Unprecedented time. And it kind of like lays it out for you. Like, these are some things you should do. And it's like some really basic things, like making sure you have cash on hand. And I think, you know, I live in earthquake country. This is Los Angeles. This is earthquake country. we have go bags. We have photocopies of our IDs in Ziploc bags in our freezer. You know, these are just things that you have to do when you're in earthquake country, which I don't think other people do. Like, being safe should just be second nature. We shouldn't have to, like, feel so scared when it comes to that things, because there are things we can do, and there are tools out there. So definitely check that out. I know that groups like CARE and the National Lawyers Guild will be doing Know Your Rights workshops. 18 Million Rising will be supporting folks through some workshops too. So if you need some sort of a training, there's a bunch of folks in the nonprofit world who are trying to create these resources for folks. So you can sign up for the 18 Million Rising list, and we can make sure that you'll get that information soon.
What I appreciate about that is it's real, you know? These are like concrete things that I can do.
Photocopy your IDs, put them in your freezer.
I'm peeing in my pants, terrified.
But while you're doing that, you can photocopy your ID and put it in the freezer. Do you know why you put it in the freezer?
I have no idea why you put it in the freezer.
It's fireproof. So like, you're supposed to like put it in some place where if anything happens, it'll be safe in the fire.
Like your passport and stuff like that.
Allegedly, yeah.
Like, I did go immediately and check to make sure that my passport didn't need to be renewed before 2020.
I heard the passport offices are all booked because people are scared.
Yeah.
So go get your passport taken care of too. Anyway, so those are some tips. We'll probably have some more tips coming up.
Fatwa time.
Fatwa. Okay, my fatwa real quick. I am fatwa-ing the term alt-right because that's bullshit. That was created as a safe terminology. It also sounds like a Nirvana-esque white Christian rock band, alt-right. But really, just say white nationalists, say neo-Nazis, say supremacists. Don't use the term alt-right, because that was a term that company of folks created to make it sound like a safer word.
Is it hard for me to watch Harry Potter anymore? Because, like, I can't stand that it's, like, white people in that narrative. It should be people of color. But I will say Harry Potter did get a lot right. And one was making all those people who are like, he's not back, he's not back, the Death Eaters are not real, like, they're deniers.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing right now with people saying things like alt-right. They're deniers.
Yeah. I'm also questioning you watching Harry Potter still now.
No, I can't. I don't. I can't. Like, I viscerally can't. Like, all I'm subscribed to is two cute episodes on Amazon. And I don't even know if I can have Amazon anymore because there's some Ivanka Trump connection.
Yeah, I know. We can boycott and we can also call Amazon.
I got the Boycott app.
Nice.
That tells you what stores to boycott and what stores to support.
Awesome. What's your fatwa?
My fatwa is, why are there not more white people protesting no DAPL?
Yeah, there needs to be more. It's been amazing to see folks going out there. We know that
there are Muslim folks protesting there. Yep. And I'm like, we are under threat. Like, I need white people to be protesting. I need to see white people mobilizing.
Yeah, we definitely need to see white folks on the front lines of this.
We need to send supplies there.
We need to send supplies there. Right? I
want to see more action, less words of comfort.
I will say this. I don't need white people to step into spaces where people of color are trying to create a safe space. Like, that's cool. We don't need white folks to be at the front line of Black Lives Matter. We don't need them to be at the front line of the Muslim Registry. We don't need them to be the representative at the front line of Standing Rock. But they should be there. They shouldn't just let people of color take the first wave of assault.
Take your cues from Bernie Sanders. He's out there. He's working. He's not done. All right, creeping Sharia time, while we can still creep Sharia. Because that was on the list of things that they're going to be looking for in the NSEERS
Sharia
reference. Yeah.
If you believe in Sharia law.
Yeah, well, and here's the thing is, like, I mean, we laugh right now, but I don't know how fast we're going to slippery slope down this hill. And I know what it's like for comedians and satirists in Iran who have to be careful about what they say because they take it literally if it suits them.
Mm-hmm.
So when we joke about creeping Sharia, like, that's nice to do before January 20th. I don't know if it's safe to do it after that. You look like you're going to crack up. What have you got? Give it to me. Give it to me, girl, because I need it. I need a laugh right now.
I mean, I just think that, like, Glenn Beck is our ultimate creeping Sharia this month. Like, I just think, I've been hearing rumors that Glenn Beck is woke now. Apparently, this Glenn Beck, who's been at the front of, he put out an Islamophobic book last year. And all of a sudden, he's the one who's in the media saying, like, Bannon is bad and having a fascist in the presidency is bad and we should not send Muslims to internment camp. Glenn Beck said this.
You know what? I'll take it. Come over here. Bring it in, Glenn.
I know. Bring it in here. I know. I was like, well, you know.
what on earth? Is this capitalism happening? Or is this, like, real?
I feel like this is like Black Mirror/Twilight Zone happening.
Oh,
the fact
God.
That Glenn Beck might be our only hope to not get sent to the internment camp. Glenn Beck, who would have known?
All right, it's time for Awkward Ask a Muslim. And I have an awkward one for you.
Yeah.
While I was in Michigan, you know, it was some, like, seeing friends and some work. And there was one day where we, like, I had this film crew with me and we were going to a slaughterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say more about it. I'm sorry I can't paint more of a picture of, like, what we're doing there in the first place. But what I can tell you is it's a Zabiha slaughterhouse. Zabiha is, like, halal to the max. All right. Basically, like, you check to make sure that, like, the animal actually is, like, taken care of humanely and, like, is killed humanely.
So you saw this?
So I go with a film crew to see this.
Yeah.
Also, small random fact, my atheist husband will only eat Zabiha meat.
Right.
We're walking in. The film crew is all dudes.
Uh-huh.
We walk in, this guy who owns the place sees me and he goes right this way and he directs me to the left while the film crew is all walking straight ahead.
Okay.
And I'm like, huh. And I thought maybe it's because I'm watching this taping, like I'm not in it.
Okay.
So maybe I can't, like, I don't want to, like, mess up the shot. So I just, like, I follow him.
Yeah.
And this other dude. And he's like, right this way. And I just keep following this dude. And we go into this other section. And this other dude that I don't know just looks at me and he smiles. And I'm, like, smiling back.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, he gets a bunch of meat. And they go, right this way again. And I just, like, follow him again toward, like, this van where they're, like, throwing a bunch of meat in. And then...
Is anyone with you right now? Like, any of your friends?
All these guys, all the Muslim guys at the, like, slaughterhouse. It's, like, Muslim slaughterhouse.
Okay.
And I'm just, like, following along. And then... The guy says, oh, your husband is about to leave without you.
Who's your husband?
He thought that the man that was in the same lobby with me was my husband.
Well, weren't you with the film crew?
I was with a film crew. I was wearing a jacket that showed that I was with the film crew. Like,
what about the man made him look like he was your husband?
I think that he was a man and I was a woman.
What?
I just thought it was so hilarious that, like, basically... I was mistaken to be this man's wife.
I mean, you were at a meat market, so. Once again, Zara is married already. Taz is single. Zara's married. And she wasn't married to the guy that was at the meat market with her. She actually has a real husband not there that was in Michigan.
Like, I just want to point out, by the way, that, like, over the course of the time that we've done this show, I've had 4 accidental husbands.
Yeah, and I've had none.
That are not my own. You've had
none.
Yeah, well, you clearly need to be hanging out at these meat markets, Taz.
I do want to go to the
Zabiha. They just marry you off. Like, they literally were
about to... You just, like, walk in and they're like, here's a husband for you. Go.
Here's a husband and a leg of lamb.
Yeah.
Go cook your first meal.
There you go. My awkward ask a Muslim happened on the plane. I was in first class, which never happens. And I actually got kind of scared because I was going to Texas State and they put me in first class. I was like, do they know how close a Muslim is to the pilot? Like, is this going to be a problem for people? And then, like, as people were walking in, I just want to be like, you know.
We joke class, about that
Muslim,
now.
Muslim first class. Anyway, so the woman that was sitting next to me, she's like, Trump is going to be on 60 Minutes. I really want to watch this. I'm just like, oh my God, like, I can't watch this right now. And I don't know how to behave. I just assumed that everyone in first class voted for Trump. You know, I think that's kind of fair, right? And so she's like, don't you want to hear, like, how he's going to frame things? And, like, I was keeping an eye out for, like, code words to see, like, did she vote for Trump? Didn't she vote for Trump? And she didn't vote for Trump. She voted for Clinton.
So you had an ally.
I had an ally.
On
first class. And we were watching the Trump interview on 60 Minutes and we would have our headphones on. And then whenever it was commercial break, we'd say, like, I can't believe he said that. Can you believe he said that? And he's so terrible and this and that. And it was a really great bonding experience with this woman on first class. I think it was refreshing. I think I was so full of fear and just, like, skepticism and betrayal of everyone around me that, mm-hmm. like, I just don't know who I can trust anymore to be a mm-hmm. non-Trump voter. And, mm-hmm. and this woman, I found an ally in this woman. And it was a positive, awkward ask a Muslim.
So do you have a good Muslim award to give?
I want to give my good Muslim award to Hira Hashmi, who was asked by a classmate why Muslims don't condemn acts of terrorism, which, of course, there's so many that do. So she stayed up all night creating an Excel spreadsheet. That is a girl of my same heart because I love Excel spreadsheets. And she created an Excel spreadsheet of 5,720 instances where Muslim groups or leaders denounce various acts of terrorism. And I think anyone that turns to Excel spreadsheets as a form of revolution, I'm just, you know, and as a girl too, it's just like, yes.
It's pretty badass.
Pretty badass.
I saw it too, and it had some color coding action going on. Oh,
good Excel spreadsheets just give me life.
I'm with you there. Mm-hmm. It's hot. Like, I think there was one period of time where we were like guys wearing t-shirts that say, I have a 401k. Hot.
Oh, yeah.
And also,
I'm good with spreadsheets. Oh, God, so hot.
I just orgasmed a little.
Yep.
All right, I have a good Muslim award to give. To SALT!
Yeah.
Not the table salt, the organization salt.
Yeah.
S-A-A-L-T. They canceled their relationship with Southwest.
Yeah.
So yes.
Southwest was giving donations of $10,000 to SALT, and they decided not to take it. And that money was funding their youth program. And they decided that after everything Southwest has done, which we know that Zara really hates,
yes,
they canceled the relationship with them.
And I have had to fly Southwest twice. Mm-hmm. Since I boycotted it last year. And it's because of nonprofit organizations that have so many points with them.
Yeah.
So I hope that this serves as an example to other organizations to see what they can do to terminate that relationship. And I fly JetBlue. Just want to put that out there again.
And I apparently fly first class in Virgin America.
Yeah, you do.
Which is a lifestyle that I could get used to.
Yeah, you know what would be nice?
Yeah.
When I'm flying red eye on top of like all of the other work that I do.
Yeah.
To like do activist work on top of comedy work, on top of teaching, on top of running workshops and things like that.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to like, you know, have my self-care also supported.
Yeah. It'd be nice to always sit in seats where there's back massagers and have non-alcoholic wine being served to you and fancy chocolates. And
wait, Virgin had back massagers?
Yes. Their first class seats have back massagers.
Wow.
I know. Thanks, Southwest, for enlightening us to all these other airlines that are out there.
Yeah. Southwest does not have massagers. They have children kicking against the back of your chair.
And stewardesses that will kick you off for saying inshallah or just for being stared at.
Or for doing your homework as an Arab-speaking Muslim.
Thanks, Southwest.
Or for having a beard. There was that also.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Memory lane. Memory lane.
Memory lane.
All right, so we're coming to the end of our podcast here.
Yeah.
And not the end forever.
No, we're still here. Buy some stickers, give us some donations, and buy some safety pins, and we'll definitely be around for much longer.
I just think it's funny that, like, you have so much confidence. My Persian diaspora ass is like, I am packing my bags ready.
Here's where my confidence comes from. The night of elections, I was talking to Humble the Poet, who is a Canadian rapper and poet, and he's really well known, and I've been following his career for a long time. And I went up to him, and he's from Canada. I was like, do you have room for me in Canada? He's like, yeah, but you don't have to worry. You'll be fine. And I was like, but don't you understand? He's like, look, once we as brown people give up the idea of safe space because we come from warriors and we come from revolution, and where we come from back home, we don't have this idea of safe space. We've been we've been fighting for a really long time. And I was like, yeah, my, you know, Bangladesh gained independence in 1971. My grandfather was a part of partition. He's like, once you start realizing that, then you can fight this because you realize you're a warrior and you have the tools in hand. And that was oddly one of the most helpful things that I needed to be reminded of, that our people, not like our American people, but our people as Iranians and our people as Bangladeshis and our people as brown people, we have a legacy of being social justice warriors. We have a legacy of fighting for what's good, and we have a legacy of being resistant in the face of oppression. So we can do this, Zara. We got this. Don't cry.
I'm gonna cry. I'm trying to hold it back. I can't. I love you, Taz.
I love you too. We'll get through this together.
And I love our listeners.
I love our listeners. Thank you so much for all the messages. It really means a lot.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. This is Shia Salavat.
Oh.
I just needed to do it. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Be safe.
Thanks for listening to the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast, hosted by Taz Ahmed and Zara Nourbash. You can follow Taz on Twitter at TazzyStar. That's TazzyStar. And Zara at Zahra Comedy. That's Z-A-H-R-A Comedy. The show is produced and edited by Quincy Sarah-Smith, and you can find us on the web at goodmuslimbadmuslim.com. To follow the conversation, please use the hashtag GoodMuslimBadMuslim. Good Muslim, Bad Muslim is a proud member of Potluck, a collective that features stories and voices from the Asian American community.